At 15 and angry, Majid Nawaz heard and followed the call of Islamist extremism. It took him from his liberal, humanist British home to senior roles with Hizb ut-Tahrir in Pakistan, Egypt and back in the UK. Then, he says, he was rehumanised. His mission now is to make the dominant voice in Islam one of tolerance of the individual. He stood for the British Parliament and founded Quilliam, a think tank focusing on religious freedom and extremism. Those progressive and liberal intentions mean the radicals he once worked with now threaten his life. Majid Nawaz is on a speaking tour in Australia and joined me a little earlier. Majid Nawaz, was there a particular siren song to radicalism for you as a young person, a particular personal slight or an injustice against fellow Muslims? What was it?
The Bosnia genocide was something that triggered my consciousness and led to an awakening politically for me. There was a genocide unfolding against Bosnia Muslims, and we in the United Kingdom were incredibly angered. A teenager at the time, 15 years old, so my young teenage mind processed that in a way typical to the very passionate and angry and black and white way that teenagers often can do.
What was the message to you as a young person, though, because you weren't a Bosnian Muslim? Why that level of identification?
Well, I think because domestically we were faced with a lot of racism, violent attacks by neo-Nazi skinheads that I was subjected to with hammers and with machetes and with screwdrivers, having to witness many of my friends stabbed before my eyes. So it was easy for an Islamist recruiter to step into that milieu and say, you know, you think that what's happening in Bosnia isn't going to happen here, but look to your own experience with violent racism that I now call the Islamist narrative, that there's a global war going on against Islam and Muslims.
And there's a real reason then to develop this grievance complex universally.
It's what I call in my autobiography radical as a half-truth. A lot of the Islamist narrative relies on real tragedies that have occurred, whether the genocide in Bosnia or the situation in the Middle East with Israel-Palestine or with Kashmir. It relies on real events, but then the conclusion that Islamists draw from those real events is false.
Did it make you necessarily racist, necessarily homophobic? Where did those ideas come from?
Well, if you think about it, once you subscribe to an ideological dogma as a solution to certain grievances, it then frames your mindset.
So that didn't come from your traditional Islamic upbringing?
No, I was raised as a liberal humanist by my parents. But my parents' generation understood Islam in a very different way. I'm yet to discover any form of theocracy that isn't homophobic, that isn't, you know, bigoted to the out-group. This is why I often say that no form of theocracy, whether it's manifested in a violent or non-violent form, is ever good for civilization, and we have to challenge it in civil society as well as we would challenge Christian-based theocracy or any other form of bigotry.
This was no dalliance. You rose to quite a senior level in Hizb ut-Tahrir and were active in Pakistan, then in Egypt, where you were arrested and tortured. Back in your home nation, you could have led the movement. Where did the change come from?
So I think two things happened to me in prison. One was that Amnesty International adopted me as a prisoner of conscience, and that led to my, it touched me in a way that really led to me opening up my heart. I've called it the rehumanization process. Basically allowed me to begin to question my own beliefs. And so the second thing that in prison happened was that I had the opportunity to debate and discuss people that had subscribed to all forms of Islamism. I had the assassins of the former president of Egypt. The leader of the Muslim Brotherhood was with me in prison. The leaders of my own former group, Hizb ut-Tahrir, were with me in prison. And so by the time I was released at the age of 28, I wasn't the man who went in at 24. When I returned to the United Kingdom, I found that I could no longer justify Islamist extremism as the antidote.
So your mission in part is to secularise the bulk of Islamic society. Obviously, some, like your parents, already live in that spectrum. But religions necessarily will always have a significant proportion of people who are absolutists because of the comfort that that brings them, that absolutism. Can you hope to secularise that sort of mind?
So, Tim, you know, you and I will remember a time when, even if we look at the violent movements that emerged in the Middle East in the 50s and the 60s and beyond into the 80s, they weren't Islamist movements. The PLO was a secular movement. If we look at Abdel Nasser in Egypt as an Arab leader, he was secular. The populism of the day was secular. So something happened in the 80s after the Afghan jihad, which changed the colour of those movements. But that teaches us something. It teaches us that it's not always the case that Muslims have been theocrats. What's happened of late is a dominant strand, a minority that is vocal, has come to hijack that debate. But my parents' generation were never theocrats. That it is possible to swing that debate around again, because within our lifetime, we can remember a time when Islamism wasn't the dominant form of discourse. The aim should be to minimize the absolutists within any religious community and contain them. And we have to render Islamist extremism as unattractive as communism has become today.
You've identified some strange fellow travellers for the Islamists in Western society, the people that you refer to as the regressive left, even in what you've written about the sexual attacks in Cologne recently. What do you mean about the regressive left?
I'm glad, actually, that you've clearly done your research. You know, I'm a progressive. What I find is that there's a subsection within the left that, instead of standing for consistency in progressive values, so feminism as applied to mainstream society as well as within minority communities, gay rights to mainstream society as well as within minority communities, instead of standing for that consistency, in the name of multiculturalism, in the name of anti-racism, in the name of diversity, we find that they are promoting progressive values for white non-Muslims, but when it comes to minority communities, they find community leaders who promote the most regressive of homophobia, of bigotry to others, anti-gender rights views, and they promote these people in the name of cultural diversity. They defend them. They believe they are the solution to Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorism, when in fact they are part of the problem. And if we are true small-L liberals, it's our job to seek out feminist Muslims, ex-Muslims, liberal Muslims, dissenting voices within Muslim communities, gay Muslims. We should promote those voices. And in doing so, we demonstrate Islam is not a monolith, Muslims are not homogenous, and the Muslims are truly internally diverse. Those Cologne attacks weren't even reported for 5 days because we feared racism. And so we've got to a stage now of totalitarianism, where we're concealing the truth for an ideological agenda. That's the regressive left.
And then when it is recognised and is in the news, the local politicians want to change the behaviour of women in Cologne.
As an example, of the regressive left, the local politicians instead suggested that women should stay at arm's length from people that look foreign. Now, apart from the inherent racism in that comment, there's a level of victim blaming. It's, you know, you would never dream of saying in the white community context that the woman's short skirt is what was to blame. Years and decades of struggle by feminists has led us to the point where we must not blame women for their rape just because how they're dressed. The problem is the rapist, not the victim. And suddenly we abandon all of that in the name of cultural pluralism and diversity because we don't want to appear racist. It's absurd.
Every government around the world is trying to find the secret to unlock real de-radicalisation as a program. What would have worked for you to get to you before the radicals, the extremists got to you?
I'm glad you said before, because I believe that preventing radicalisation is far more efficient than de-radicalisation, meaning, you know, stopping someone joining is a lot easier than trying to pull someone out once they've joined. And so in my case, when I was 16 and I was witnessing the genocide in Bosnia and I had domestic racism at home, what would have helped a great deal were a few things. One of them, a recognition by politicians of the day that there's a problem that needs to be solved. If you remember, there was an arms embargo that prevented the Bosnians from arming themselves. Now, Syria, I believe President Obama and the international community has been incredibly slow in solving that problem. So there's a new Bosnia for the younger generation. So immediate and decisive action is important. The other thing I'd say is role models. Young, Muslim, educated role models who are secular, who are small-L liberal, who advance human rights, and who are incredibly candid in their honesty and ability to speak to these issues. And I think that we need slightly bit less defensiveness around the topic of extremism, as my fellow Muslims, and a bit more honesty about the fact there is a challenge, because that does immediately, it does two things. It proves to the far right that Muslims aren't just Trojan horse, you know, denialists who are wanting to pretend there's no problem because they secretly want to take over. But also it provides a role model for that young, angry teenager so they can look to these successful, young, educated Muslims and say, I want to be like him. I don't want to be like Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the so-called caliph of ISIS.
Majid Nawaz, thank you very much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you, Tim.
That was the visiting author and founding chairman of Quilliam, Majid Nawaz.